On this week's 51%, a four-time U.S. team medalist in the martial arts was the victim of sexual abuse.
And I think it was a game for him to know that I would learn how to defend myself against other people and, in fact, teach other people how to do it. But he knew I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't defend myself against him.
And hear from an indie folk artist whose works walk the line between personal and political. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Bearing the burden of a secret storm. Sometimes she wishes she was never born.
Tammy Stamps is a U.S. Taekwondo team medalist, a singer and songwriter, and fifth-degree black belt master instructor. She's also a victim of sexual abuse suffered at the hands of her father during four decades. She tells her story in a memoir called Our Time, a true story of 43 years of abuse, survival, and a life changed forever. Stamps, a Kansas native who now lives in Texas, formed Rise Up, which stands for Regain Inner Self-Esteem Using Power. It's a way to teach anti-bullying tactics to empower domestic violence victims, and it has evolved into helping girls, boys, and adults. She spoke with 51%'s Elizabeth Hill about what made her break the abuse cycle.
I wish I could say it was me. It was actually someone else. I had my martial arts academy, and we were going to be having a talent show on a Saturday. So my students were going to do their talent on Saturday afternoon, and I was going, I'm a singer, and so I was going to sing that evening for my students. And so I had a makeshift stage, and all the students and some friends were in front of me, but there was one chair behind me, and that was where my father sat. And I noticed when I was singing, I had a friend of mine that kept looking at him. And I thought, well, that's weird, but I didn't think that much about it. And the next day, she came up to me. I was by myself, and she said, Tammy, someone's hurt you. I said, no, they haven't. But the minute she said that, my heart just jumped into my throat and my life was changed forever. The next day, she said, you know, I was hoping she would go away and forget it because you want someone to see, but you're so scared that they will.
Yeah.
So the next day she came up and she said, Tammy, I know who it was. And I said, who? And she said, your father. And within a week, I was gone because she said it. I didn't have to. She saw it. The way I grew up, my dad was had been in the military, and he just beat into our heads, my sister and myself, betrayal, you know, loyalty. You would never betray me. And if you do, you know, I'll kill you.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I was too scared to say anything. And so I had a mask for 43 years, and no one saw through it until that one night.
How did you recover from such a long abuse cycle?
Well, you know, it's kind of funny because I still am. A friend of mine asked me yesterday, in fact, she said, Tammy, you know, did you get into martial arts because you wanted to, or did you do it because your dad wanted you to? You know, we were talking about, I have this kind of obsession with food.
Yeah.
I didn't do drugs or anything like that, but that was the one thing that always brought me joy. But being in martial arts and competing, you had to be at a certain weight. And my dad would always give me a hard time about what I was eating. And so to this day, it's a trigger when somebody says, well, do you really need that? Like, yes, I do. And so she said, because your nutrition, you don't seem like you're that into it. It seemed like your dad was the one. And I had honestly never thought of that. And I started really trying to process what she said. And it was kind of life changing in the fact that, you know, I got into martial arts because I love sports, but I always like confidence. But when I started succeeding in it, I felt like I wanted to be impressive and do impressive things because there was nothing inside me.
Yeah.
So I wanted other people to view me as, wow. And there wasn't a wow inside me. It was kind of gratification from the outside.
I'm sure you're asked this quite a bit, but why, as a four-time U.S. team medalist in the martial arts, couldn't you fight back against your father?
It's kind of strange there because I was molded as a little kid. I was the youngest of three, which we were all girls, but one didn't live with us. And so you're molded as a little kid. You know, you love your dad and you hate your dad. Yeah. You hate what he's doing. The abusers kind of play a carrot and a stick game. They're nice to you, and then they abuse you, and you're confused, and they're confused why you hate them. And, you know, it's very difficult. But I will say there were times that it was like there was a piece of saran wrap between, you know, harming him and not. And it was fear. It was fear that stopped me. And my dad was the one that got me into martial arts. And I think, well, I know he was a sociopath, and I think it was a game for him to know that I would learn how to defend myself against other people and, in fact, teach other people how to do it. But he knew I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't defend myself against him. He trained me and threatened me and molded me as such that I just, you just emotionally, you're frozen, and you can't make sense of, you know, that other side of that wax paper. Because I had several occasions, obviously, where he was very vulnerable. Yeah. And I could have. But fear, I would just have to say I was scared. I was frozen.
Have you had the chance to confront your father about this? Or was your book more of a way to come to that sort of closure?
When I left that situation, I escaped at 3 a.m. with my dog and my clothes. And I ended up, I was the last sibling there. And so I just wanted to leave. But my mom and I thought we were very close. So I had called the police to go and check on her the next day, and she refused to leave. The police said the only way you can get her out is to press charges. I said, fine, I'll do that. So I pressed charges against my father, and the investigator who was investigating the case told me, he said, your dad is twisted, but he's a good man. Just blew me away. Anyway, I did press charges, and I told the investigator, I said, you know, whatever. I don't have a sibling. I just want my life. I want to live. I don't care. So the only time I had a visual of my father after that was when I get a protection from abuse order from him because he and my mother were stalking me. And so that was the last time I saw him. And so when I wrote my book, it was more closure for me. And during the writing of my book, my father passed away. So I got to write about that and how that affected me as well.
And how did that affect you?
Well, it affected me differently than I thought. My sister was at the hospital with him, and I had asked her, because I had no contact with my mother either, because she stood by my father. But my sister was at the hospital and took a picture of my father and sent it to me. And my, you know, heart was beating in my chest. I don't know why. I was so scared of him. But I clicked on the picture, and he looked like an old, frail man. But I zeroed in on his face and his eyes. I will never forget those eyes. And he still had the power. It was so scary. But I realized he was just an old man and he was getting ready to die. But I was surprised at myself when he passed away. I actually had a little bit of compassion because when he died, they didn't have a service for him. It was like a human being to be on this earth and to die alone and not have anyone care, which, you know, I hated him and I loved parts of him, but I hated him. But at that moment, it just brought the human factor in and it made me sad. But that night after he passed away, I talked to him out loud because your voice is the strongest part of you. And I, you know, basically told him out loud, I hated him. I hated what he did. You know, there were good times, but there were only good times because he got what he wanted. I wished him, you know, if there is a second chance and a second life, I hope that he would come back a better man and learn, you know, from what he did to myself and my sister.
Having gone through this, what do you think society needs to do to protect the innocent and the voiceless from these cycles of abuse that you see all over?
I think, number one, you have to believe people. I mean, there are enough people out there that say things that aren't true, that make all of us that it did happen, you know, people don't believe you. But I would say, to me, you care enough about the people you love to look in their eyes, not to just say, hey, good morning, and walk on, but actually take a moment and look, because that's where we hide our pain. That's where we hide our secrets. That's the only way that people can see it. You know, this is my opinion. It's not based on fact, but no, if you're under 18 and you're being abused, that's a horrible, horrible situation, because you can be taken out of your home and be put in foster homes and be abused all over again. In my opinion, the perpetrator needs to be taken out of the home and the child needs to be left in a loving home. And so society just needs to care enough to say something, to look, number one, to say something, number two, and to believe that person.
When did you decide that writing the memoir was something that you wanted to do?
I am a better writer than I am a speaker, and so I'm more comfortable by myself in that mode. And so when I left and I escaped, I started writing, just to heal. But everything was so raw that I put it away. And about 3 to 5 years ago, my healing journey was not working so well for me, and I felt like I tried everything. So I ended up contacting a therapist in Florida. Her name's Joan Childs. She had what they call a 5-day intensive, where it's nonstop therapy. I went there and did the therapy with her. And when she heard my story, she said, "Tammy, I've done this for over 40 years. And she said, "I've never heard a 10 before. She said, "Yours is a 10, and you need to tell your story and help other people." And at that moment, when I left the therapy, I went home and I started rewriting my book. And that's how that happened.
You are also a musician, and music can help you heal in ways that many other outlets can't. How do you feel music or the arts helped you heal?
I really feel like martial arts and music, so movement and music, helped me survive, along with a couple of other things. But I've had a couple of therapists tell me, "Tammy, that's what saved your life, was your music and your martial arts. It does something to your neurons, I guess." But music for me was a way to have a voice I never had. When I started writing my music, after I left that situation, I started writing and singing. And the nice thing about music is people didn't know whether I wrote the song for me or I wrote it for someone else that had to do with abuse. And so I could still hide some of myself behind it. Once I wrote my book, everything changed for me. And I was able to have emotion in my voice. But music saved my life, because Celine Dion, you know, whether anyone likes her or not, I think she's awesome. And when I was growing up, I would put my headphones on and I would crank her music up and go in my room. And her voice, for some reason, for the frequency of her voice, I could feel it from my toes through my head. And it actually was one thing that made me feel. I could feel. And without her music, I really honestly don't know what I would have done. I mean, I was suicidal a lot of the time. And then martial arts, of course, gave me an outlet for my rage that was a positive way to do it, and a controlled way, obviously. But it helped me with the yelling and the screaming that you do in martial arts. It really helped, and it helped me start to believe in who I was.
And you mentioned you did martial arts to begin with as like a wow factor, and you obviously still do martial arts. Have you internalized yet that you are kick butt at what you do?
Well, I don't know if I'm that, but I do know what I'm doing, and I think what's empowering for me is to teach other people to see them grow and to find the power within themselves. I think that's why I really am doing it now. I teach self-defense to faculty and staff at the university I work at. And as far as the martial arts, teaching it, I do it one-on-one or something, but I don't have my academy anymore. But the self-defense for me is empowering. And, you know, it reminds me that it doesn't take a whole lot to defend yourself. So it is empowering and it is confidence building. But you still know you're vulnerable.
And you formed Rise Up in the 90s. Can you explain that a little bit?
Rise Up is kind of a combination, and it's evolved through time since I left. But it's a mixture of my martial arts, my music, and my story. And so the martial arts aspect is teaching self-defense, basic self-defense. My music is about abuse and empowerment, and because, like you said, music can touch the soul where words just don't, you know, the spoken word. And then my story. I'm free to tell my story now. before I hid behind it and acted like nothing was wrong. I remember teaching the domestic violence victims, and I stood up there the very first day and I said, I don't stand here to pretend that I know what you're going through, because I don't. So I was lying, because I knew very well what they were going through. That whole event of teaching those women empowered me and gave me that rise up feeling in my soul. At that time, obviously, I was still in the abuse, and I didn't feel like I could do anything. So I was doing it through them, you know, giving them the power to do it in their lives. When I started doing my book signings, yeah, I have music, but I also have slides behind them. And one in particular, I sang with, it's called Unbreakable. It's a song I wrote. And on the slide, it has a woman with her back facing you, and she's holding a red balloon. So it's up in the air a little bit. And in front of her, there's this beautiful landscape. And so what this is about, this is about the way we view life. And I know for me, being from an abusive background that's been horrible, I would focus on that red balloon, and I would tell my audience that that red balloon stands for grief and pain and hate and rage, everything ugly in your life. And most people that have been abused look at that, and that's all they see day in and day out, and that's all they feel, and it's a reminder, and they can't escape it. I said, now, I want you to look away from that balloon and see the beauty that surrounds you, and then find the beauty within you. If you focus on that red balloon, that's what your life is going to be like. You've got to change your view. And so, you know, for empowerment for me at that moment, even I didn't plan on saying that, but at my book signing, it just happened. And I thought, yeah, that's, you know, there comes a moment in your life when it's a wow moment for you that says, you know, I'm a survivor, and my heart's beating, and I'm so proud of myself, and you begin to love yourself finally.
What do you think about other athletes who have recently come forward to deal with abuse?
You know, I think it's really a sad situation because, you know, especially in sports, I heard Oprah say this the other day. It was a recording, but it said, the disease to please. And I definitely had that. And I think athletes do, as far as their coaches. You know, you have trust. They're your mentors. They're people you look up to, like your parents. You don't expect them to take advantage of you. So, you know, you have a disease to please to make sure that you're doing what they want you to do. And I applaud those women, applaud them wholeheartedly, just that they're standing up. And whether people, you know, stand with them, you've got to stand on your own. Once you stand up, just like they're doing, other people will get the courage to stand up beside them. And that's how we become strong.
That was Tammy Stamps speaking with 51%'s Elizabeth Hill about her memoir, Our Time, a true story of 43 years of abuse, survival, and a life change forever.
Let the rain come down and wash away my tears. Let it fill my soul and drown my fears. Let it shatter the walls for a new sun.
Obesity is a major problem across the U.S. It affects about 40% of the population, and it's even worse in Midwestern states like Ohio, Illinois, and Indiana. Side Effects Public Media's Araceli Gomez-Aldana reports that addressing the problem is complicated.
Erin Pacetti is a single mom in her 40s and works as a wealth manager. But for years, the Indiana woman had a secret.
I was sneaking out of work to go to the fast food restaurants, order something, inhale it, and then sneak back into work. At home, I'd buy groceries for the week, and at night I'd come home, and those 1 week worth of groceries were gone within 2-3 hours.
She tried fasting, all the diets, the Weight Watchers, Jenny Craig, nothing worked. And one day, it all became overwhelming.
I hit rock bottom when I dropped a pen at the office and I couldn't pick it up. I literally burst out in tears crying and knew that I needed to change.
That was back in 2016, when she finally realized it was compulsive behavior.
So the way I look at it is I'm addicted to food. So I may not have an eating disorder per se, but I cannot stop sometimes. And it is just disabling, and you can't move forward.
Pasetti sought out a weight loss program led by Ashley Cuellar Gilmore, a gastroenterologist at Indiana University Health, and that meant confronting the stigma of obesity. Dr. Gilmore recognizes that stigma is a challenge. Even in her line of work, health insurance doesn't pay for most weight loss treatment.
People who have obesity, it's considered almost like a character flaw, kind of more of a cosmetic issue. But I do believe that the scientific community has come around, and I'm hoping that our society is coming around to viewing it as a disease.
Dr. Ronald Ackerman, a professor at Northwestern University, agrees. He says talking about blame is unproductive when it comes to personal health.
You know, some people are simply more predisposed to carry the weight or to keep the weight, and it's not their fault.
Ackerman calls the nation's increasing obesity rate a societal problem. Even if patients learn about the benefits of healthy food and exercise, they might not live near supermarkets or parks.
So we teach people these skills, and they never graduate from the environment. You know, they always are going to be living in an environment that's supportive of them gaining weight.
To curb obesity rates, Dr. Ackerman says there needs to be a change in a person's mindset and more healthy environments. Indiana has a strategic plan that includes providing broader access to healthy foods and safe places for physical activity, but the results may not be visible for 30 years. Most people can't wait 30 years, and the health risks associated with obesity are hard to ignore. Dr. Ackerman says losing 10 to 15 pounds can reduce hypertension and high cholesterol. It's also enough to reduce the use of medications. When it comes to seeking medical attention to lose weight, there are a few options: medication, surgeries, non-surgical procedures, and methods that involve a bit of everything, including a therapist and a dietitian. That's what Pasetti chose.
I do not want surgery. It is not something that I can change overnight with weight loss surgery. This is something that needs to be changed, and I will struggle with for the rest of my life.
Pasetti says she needed help every step of the way, but it's working. After almost 2 years of following Dr. Gilmore's weight loss program, she lost 120 pounds. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Araceli Gomez-Aldana.
In her lyrics, singer-songwriter Rachel Kilgore does not shy away from female pronouns. Blessed her lips and the turn of her wrists, try and tempt me, I will not resist. KFAI's Dixie Trichel produced this audio portrait.
We were tiny young things when they filled our heads with love songs, the fable, romantic affair.
My name is Rachel Kilgore, and I am a songwriter and performing artist. I grew up in Duluth, Minnesota. And I, as a songwriter, have always used female pronouns to describe the people I was in relationship with and really didn't think twice about it. But more recently, have had some dear friends share their experiences of the difficulties they've had with their families and communities and coming out. Recently on this new EP, I have a new song called Holy Are We that discusses that kind of bridge that people are looking for between faith and queer sexuality. That's an important conversation to have, and it's a tricky one for a lot of families and a lot of queer folks.
Holy are we, with her hand on my knee, and on you.
The EP kind of feels like a list of intentions for my 30s. Game Changer, the title, refers to this new phase of my life. My previous album, Rabbit in the Road, dealt with the fallout of a difficult divorce. This new EP is examining my very tentative steps back into a relationship for the first time again and figuring out how to be the kind of person I want to be.
I could love you if you were ready. Game changer, cling to me, your love.
I perform solo almost all of the time. I prefer the intimacy that that gives the audience. I put a lot of intention into really putting out my more difficult emotional processes in front of people and inviting them to examine their own histories at the same time. And I would say that the audience's response varies depending on their comfort level with that kind of intimacy and emotional content. But often at the end of a show, people will come up to me and share their own stories. I think it's an important place to go to. I think we're all a little bit lonely and disconnected from one another. So even though it can sometimes be uncomfortable, it feels like an important place to invite people to join me at.
That was award-winning indie folk singer-songwriter Rachel Kilgore. Her latest album is Game Changer. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says she'd like to see a woman on the Democrats' 2020 presidential ticket, but she's not insisting on it. The California Democrat said in a recent interview with the Associated Press that it should not be surprising that a few men have risen to the top of the large Democratic field. She says she's very proud of the women in the contest, and she says anyone running would be better than President Donald Trump. Asked if she'd see a problem if Democrats nominate only men for the ticket, she replied, no. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Elizabeth Hill for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. And follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1552.